You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives.
Recently, literacy scholar Elaine Richardson came to visit Syracuse University. During her visit, she presented her one-woman show based on her memoir, From PhD to PhD, How Education Saved My Life. We had a chance to sit and chat to talk about the George Zimmerman trial, the memoir itself, African-American rhetoric, and even RuPaul.
I was going to say, I guess we could get some.
Okay, here's my first question. This is easy. From PhD to PhD.
Oh, so we going?
We've been going.
Oh, no!
This is the real beginning.
Okay, so the book PhD to PhD, Po-Ho and Dope, How Education Saved My Life. Now, if that don't sound like a Millie Jackson song, I don't know what does.
I love that.
But yeah, so, okay. Why your story? Why now? Give me a good exigency.
I think the title is to try to be true to myself. It's where I came from. So I wanted to have that there, especially because there's so many people that are there. And I want to work, you know, I want the book to work in the lives of people who might feel like they've been written off. Mm-hmm. You know, it might feel like you are just regulated or designated into a certain life and you don't have to be. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because everybody's got gifts and talents and dreams and stuff that they want to be. But it's like once people label you, you know, that label traps you into, you know, mm-hmm. situations and circumstances. And it doesn't have to. So that's what I was trying to go for. Like, yeah, okay, yeah, I was a po-ho, I'm dope. And, you know, I admit that. And?
Now that we've confirmed that, now
yes.
What?
Yes. Okay, and so now I'm going for mine. I'm going mm-hmm. for mine. I'm not letting people tell me what that po-ho, I'm dope means.
Right.
I'm making it what I want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just want to be true to where I came from.
What I love about it is that you really complicate an archetype or a narrative that we're very familiar with. When I first met you, one of the things I said to you, I was like, I like you so much because you remind me of people I know. Specifically, you remind me of my favorite aunt. She struggled with substance abuse all her life. She actually ended up dying a couple of years ago. But one of the things that I see so much of a connection between your story and the stories that I'm familiar with is, like, for instance, you're from Cleveland. I'm from Memphis. Memphis and Cleveland are both formerly thriving towns that are black towns, but now in industry has left and all that type
yes.
of stuff. So there are similar things going on. But specifically, I'll be honest, at parts of the presentation, I was uncomfortable on purpose. I know it's your purpose to make it uncomfortable.
Okay.
But I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to give you one scene in particular that I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
It was a rape scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're giving us the conversation between you and the guy. And then he breaks into this, how do I want to say, this language of, ooh, let me just touch it, let me just see it, let me just do. And so at the moment, I bust out laughing in myself, not because the scene itself is funny, but
uh-huh.
because you captured that moment so well. Like, you mm-hmm. captured how this type of dude talks in that type of moment, because you lived the life, of course. So my question kind of is, how do people, are people responding to these moments, these more controversial moments?
I think the way that you did. I think it's natural for people to laugh with stuff that's, you know, funny but not funny. Or, did she say that? You know, like, it's that kind of thing. So laughter is very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So far, people who come up to me and talk to me about the performance, so far, they just tell me how it touched them, or, you know, like, they were glad that there were some funny parts, and, or, you know, oh my God, you made me cry, or, you know, stuff like that. But nobody so far has said, you embarrassed me, you disgusted me, and mm-hmm. why did you do that, and I'm not feeling you.
Right.
So, thank God I've, you know,
real.
Not, gotten that.
You're giving us realness, though. That's why it's hard to complain or have any type of critique like that, because it's like, no, this is life. Like, at least for those of us who know.
Thank you.
Another kind of monologue that you did, it was of the bottom bitch of Andrew. When you put the wig off on Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to disagree with what she was saying, but I understood every, like, the rules of the game. Uh-huh, you know? Uh-huh. And it just had such a profound effect on me.
Uh-huh. And she was giving me an education.
Yes.
That's another form of education. Mm-hmm. This is how you work the streets, at least in the type of, you know, how we gonna work it.
Right.
You know, and so she could have not told me anything, because basically she was my rival. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know what I mean? She could have just let me go on out there and not know how to, you know, do some things, right. You know? But she told me how she worked. This is how she worked, you know, so.
And it's how she worked in a specific context.
Right, in that context.
Because that's where it gets all rhetoric-y. Yes. It's like, these are the rules for this particular game.
Right. That's it.
And that subjectivity thing, especially in this book, is such a key part, because I remember something that stuck out with me and Blair was one of the things that you said was we were going on a date like normal people.
Yes.
That stabbed me and Blair in our hearts right
there. It can make me cry too. It can make me cry because I never felt like a normal person.
I could relate.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And people say things around you all the time that make you feel like you're not normal. And so, even though people probably look at that and, well, how can you say that you loved a pimp? Or how could you even think that a pimp loved you? You know, like I said, people put you in a box and they label you. And nobody really is normal. How do we know what that is? What does that mean? We're all human beings. What does that mean that we're not normal? You know what I mean? We all feel love, pain, hate. We feel all the things that human beings can feel. Jealousy, everything. When you consume that abnormality from the people around you, you believe it. It's complicated.
I can relate. As a Black queer person, you know, that normal thing, like, because the reason it cut us is because, again, dating and all that type of stuff.
Yes.
That's reserved for normal straight people. Right, and so we're like, oh, she hit it. Because it's like, oftentimes we're surprised if we go out on a date or like get married and stuff like that. You're not supposed to be granted these normal things.
That's right. And even though I was in an abusive situation and agreeing with it, you know what I mean? Because people look at it when you are a street hooker like I was and you're with pimps, there's no, like, you don't need therapy. You know what I mean? Like, you want to be out there. You love to be with pimps. You love jumping out of cars. You love niggas putting knives up to your throat every night. This is what you chose. People use that language of choice.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But that was my life. And it was a life where I was vulnerable, and it's a life that allows people to write you off. And that's why I wanted to bring up the part about, you know, when you're a Black or poor person from an unpreferred group, you're not human trafficked. You're just a hoe. Mm-hmm. You know, so again, when people put a label on what it is, it's like it's a license for people to write you off. And if you get killed or whatever your pain is, nobody has to care about it because you chose it.
Definitely.
You chose that life.
Mm. One thing that I find so interesting, specifically as a graduate student here, is one, we're studying all this research. We're, again, majority of people, old white people, whatever. But naturally, I'm seeing connections all throughout my life. Like, not just life the past couple of years, but life since I was a little kid. And so one of the reasons I'm going there is because one thing, people always talk about Jay-Z using his hustle skills of being, you know, a crack dealer to transition to this or to transition to be a mogul.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how much of your skills, like how much of that informed your work now? Like
being on the street?
Yeah, like I'm sure it did.
I understand what it means to work hard, you know, from a lot of different perspectives. My mother was an immigrant. You know, you grinding. you know, just from being poor and in the hood, you got to survive. So mm-hmm. I understand grinding. So when I got to graduate school or school period, mm-hmm. when I got to Cleveland State, when I came back and I was like, I'm not going to let anybody turn me around. I'm going to do this because I really had nothing else to do at that point. Right. I knew that I had to work hard, just like how I worked the streets. I knew that I had to work hard. I knew that I had to do what I had to do to survive up in here. And Geneva Smitherman told me, don't lose your street knowledge. You need mm-hmm. that. I understand that. I really could mm-hmm. apply that. I could apply that. And also, I guess the rhetorical aspects of it, too. Because when you're out in the street, you're playing different roles all the time.
Rhetorical agility.
Come on now.
All right.
Go ahead. Go ahead, nephew. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm. It's all real. Connected.
It's real. It is. It is.
It's all connected.
It is. And you're so right about these arbitrary divisions that we make. It's these discourses. That's what it is. These discourses, and we're not understanding that they're very hybrid, you know, and that things that apply in one apply in another, just in a different context.
Because they're all informed by ideology.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Because it's like with me personally, I'm doing, remember at the conference I said I was trying to do work with shade or throwing shade?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
And so it's actually expanded, and like it's gone from me just explaining what shade is in an academic context to me using shade to talk about language policy and all that type of stuff. Mm. But one thing that I find interesting is just even the fact of how to approach academia, how you have to explain this perspective. As soon as I mention shade, I have to go into the whole lifestyle, the whole, you know, subjectivity that informs shade. These rhetorics, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
And so that's something from last night stuck out when you were writing in grad school. That's your language. These are your experiences. So you right. have to.
Right. That's mm. right. That's right.
Let me see what else I've... Oh, here's a question. I asked about your about people's response. How has the field responded? Composition and rhetoric or academia?
Well, the people who have taken time to give me some feedback have been very receptive. You know, I don't know how to read a lot of blank faces. Mm-hmm. Wow. I do know how to read some of them, but they're the ones who don't really give me any feedback except the blank faces. But the people who have, I mean, I've gotten some really good feedback from Valerie Lee. She is the chief diversity officer at OSU. She is an African-American literature professor by training, even though now she's in administration. She's an African-American literature professor. So she was giving me, you know, like analyses that only somebody trained, mm-hmm. like, you know, in that way could give me. Because, you know, I'm rhetoric and linguistics. I'm not literature per se. She gave me some great stuff. And then just... you know, people like Dr. Tamika and mm-hmm. Gwen, people who've been teaching the book in their class, they give me different things. So Gwen was telling me like what they talk about in her class from a black feminist perspective of, you know, like, so why was it that I was vulnerable to pimps besides the trauma? You know, I'm sure the trauma was there too, but why in school? What is it about, you know, like school was not holding her attention? You know, there are a lot of smart little black girls sitting in classrooms that are bored. Mm-hmm. You know, so they were talking about stuff from, you know, a black feminist perspective and looking at my book from like an on-the-ground perspective. What can we learn from this book to help our scholarship more... you know, have a reach in the community, in the lives of people, and rather than it just being some right. academic, theoretical, this, that, and the other about empowerment of black women and girls. And, you know, so...
we need to talk about that.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and talk about that before... Because I told you, like, similarities between Memphis and Cleveland. Syracuse got the same stuff. Former mm-hmm. industrial town, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And so, like, at the barbershop. So I'm just getting my hair cut. You would think this was out of a damn movie. So I'm just getting my hair cut, you know, getting my look right. Uh-huh. And so this 13-year-old boy walks in. It's about 1 o'clock in the middle of a weekday. And son, this is my barber. She's like, you know you can't be here during school hours. What the hell? You know the rules up in here. That's something within itself, that the fact that there are rules. Good. But he was like, I'm suspended. And so naturally, I'm thinking Trayvon Martin as soon as he says he's suspended from school. I'm like, oh, damn, it's real. It's real. So then I ask him to tell the story about how he got suspended. He tells this long story about chasing this boy around the cafeteria, throwing stuff, like some animated stuff. And I was like, how about this? Would you mind writing that down for me? And he was like, okay. And I'm getting my hair cut, and he stopped to write 3 paragraphs about what happened. Mm-hmm. I'm shocked to shit that this boy did this. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't even put together. Mm-hmm. But so, as the conversation goes on, I'm talking to him. It just broke my heart so bad, because it's that lack of opportunity, so then lack of imagination. Actually said, I don't care about anything. Now, when he said that, I could relate, because at 12, I only cared about so much anyway.
Okay, right.
But, and then, like, when you talk about future, said, probably going to prison, and being dead serious, though. Dead serious. And so, that's why I wanted to bring it back to you and the girls, or young black girls, not having opportunities, mm-hmm. or not having the right exposure, so mm-hmm. it limits...
Mm-hmm. What you can see for yourself. Yeah, if you can't see anything for yourself, and all you seeing around you, I mean, you what you see. And then the media doesn't make it any better at all. I really feel like a lot of us are disconnected from education. We might go there every day. We might not get in trouble. We might get good grades, but we're still disconnected because it's not relevant to your life. They don't make it relevant to your life. And that's why I like literacies and, you know, critical literacy education, because you can't separate reading from poverty, right. from capitalism, from, you know, mm-hmm. other forms of exploitation. You can't separate reading
put in
from
the
that.
Material.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what passes for education in a lot of classrooms is just like so disconnected from my everyday life. Because when I walk out of here, I got to walk past a whole bunch of shit to get home, you know? And then when I get home, what I'm seeing in my house is so different from what I'm seeing on television, and I can't make, what's the connection? I know I don't have any money, and they keep telling me if I just, although I was, if I could read, then my house wouldn't be like this, you know? But they're not, the connections are right. not being, it's not, you know?
And people not critically engaging with why the hell you can't read in the first place, you know?
Right. It's not because I'm not able to.
Right.
You know?
And especially when I'm reading in so many different ways.
Thank you.
Outside
thank
of
you.
That.
This little narrow way that you exactly. want for your test.
Oh, I was going to ask you actually about genre. So... Well, the memoir, I'm pretty sure you picked a memoir because you had a story. But why a one-woman show? That's very intriguing to me.
I think performance helps you to know in a way that you know. It's like expressing that embodied knowledge in another way that can reach somebody. You know what I mean? Because sometimes on the page, you know, it's one thing, but that performance piece... It's not only going to reach somebody else, but it's also reaching me mm-hmm. again. You know what I mean? It's reaching me again. And it's reaching people in different ways. People who might not have been a poho on dope, but, you know, like how different parts you say jumped out at you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I knew that a lot of people need to hear, like, the patois. They need to hear the language of E68th and Cedar in Cleveland. They need mm-hmm. to hear the after out what's going. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, and also to humanize, you know, like these were real people I'm talking mm-hmm. about. You know what I mean? These are real people's lives. And so I think that there's just something in performance that you can't get from the page.
Mm-hmm. I love that you're stressing that they're real people, because I have this kind of theory in my mind that whenever you're telling real stories, inherent in there is a critique. Because it's like, as soon as we understand your story, or even, was it AC who grew up rich, but, or
all grew right. up in a good neighborhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, not rich, but grew up in a good neighborhood. Like, as soon as you start to examine these dynamics, it's hard to not critique the larger system that makes it so that these yeah. things are happening.
Yeah.
But yeah. I love the idea of a one-woman show. I'm actually kind of struggling with genre. Everything is a combination of different yes. identities yes. and layering and stuff. Yes. So it's like, it's yes. hard not to bring
yes.
you know, yes. my love for pop culture, yeah. My love for performance and all these things to yeah. the classroom or yeah. to
right.
my scholarship.
And that's what I was trying to say. And I still don't know if I answered that brother's question well last night. Is that we've been taught to kind of section ourselves off, mm-hmm. you know? So, and that's what's happening to kids in classrooms too, is that mm-hmm. you're not engaging my person. You're not engaging my person. You're trying to isolate, you know, like this kind of knowledge from this kind of knowledge, mm-hmm. and they inform each other. And I've been just figuring out on this journey how to put my whole self together. And that's what it is with
that's
your,
radical.
With your performance. Mm-hmm. It's putting your whole self together.
Now, I have a question. This is probably about the largest system and all this other type of stuff. Like, I remember in, I think, Tony Scott's book, Dangerous Writing, one of his critiques is that, well, we're trying to do, like, say, all this progressive liberal stuff, but also the classroom exists within a larger institution
right.
that inhibits the work that we're trying to do.
Isn't that something?
And so, like, and I definitely think about it like this. How am I going to tell a student that their home language has beauty and power and all this when the rest of the world is saying it doesn't?
But I still think you got to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. It can be accepted. Are you willing to learn about yourself? You know what I mean? Because some mm-hmm. people feel like they don't have to know about themselves because it's discredited knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But are you willing to learn about yourself? Are you willing to embrace yourself? Embrace your history. Embrace. And it doesn't mean that all, you know, people always go there, well, all black people don't speak right. Ebonics. Okay, well, whatever it is that you do speak, are you willing to embrace it? Right. Are you willing to embrace your ancestors? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Now, how do you think I should approach use of non-academic English in academic discourse?
You have to be critical about any language that you're using. Mm-hmm. So as long as they showing me some criticality, I'm with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to always, criticality is going to be central to everything we do. Because you got to know what you're doing. Right? You got to know who your audience is. And it's not that you can't use hip-hop discourse up in here because we're in Syracuse University. You can use hip-hop mm-hmm. discourse. And I want you to use it rhetorically. You know, I need you to become persuasive with your writing so mm-hmm. that when people read it, they don't care what all kind of languages you put up in here because you got me open.
Right.
You got to get me open with your writing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is to learn how to write. And that we shut people down because we want this, that academic narrow stuff. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? We want that academic narrow thing that can just get you past. It'll pass you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really nothing that people can sink their teeth into.
Right.
There's some folk who can write, though. I love reading a lot of the, like, the crunk feminists and,
mm-hmm.
you know, people yes. who can write.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin can write. You know, I don't consider myself as a creative writer, even mm-hmm. though, you know, for some people, I can just read anything they write.
Mm-hmm.
They can write Mary Had a Little Lamb, but they write it in their way.
Exactly.
You know, and they could be writing about, you know, a lot of complex issues, but they write it in their way, and it reaches the heart, like they say in the Baptist church. If it comes from the heart, it'll reach.
That's what I love about African-American vernacular language and all that, because I find myself doing that when I'm teaching, too.
I do, too.
Because that call and response, I never noticed it until I got here, even though I knew what call and response is, that I was standing there in front of a class and wait for them to give me something.
Give me
back.
Something. Give me. Don't leave me up here by myself.
Not to mention, I feel like part of it is vanity, thinking I'm in front of an audience. So y'all gonna clap or jump up and down or something. You know, somebody better do something. Now, let me look at this list and make sure I asked up. Because we really naturally went through just about everything that I had to ask about. Yeah, because my last question was going to be, what's your approach to teaching like multiple language or dealing with multiple literacies in the composition classroom?
I think we need them. I mean, you know, not try to shut them down. You know, I'm teaching a class this semester that has some visiting Indonesian scholars in it, and it's such a blessing because it's a linguistics for literacy class. And so when they teach about linguistics for literacy coming from another country and talking about English in that context and how they learned English and, you know, just the complications around how people think they're teaching ESL over here, it gives the the American white teachers in my classroom a whole nother perspective to think about. So it's so good to have diversity, and that diversity be in a position of authority. Because when those Indonesian scholars are teaching from their perspective, it empowers their knowledge, and it lets the teacher see from another perspective how inadequate their training is.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And so when we talk about diversity, a lot of times we just talk about having people in the room where diversity is like empowering that other knowledge that's in the room. Put that knowledge in a position of authority so you can see how the world works from another perspective and how you just don't even understand. You think you know so much, but you really have so much more to learn.
Because that's also why having like women, minorities, and oppressed people as professors is so radical. Because you have to, because I think about it, just even me being a Black male professor, and then I'm also out with my students, because I feel like I have to be. It's be part real. Of critical consciousness. It's part of all that type of stuff.
That's right.
So if we're gonna talk about Blackness, I gotta queer it.
Okay.
But so just me being in the place complicates all those things. Mm-hmm. And so then I was talking to one of my international students, and he was nervous about his writing, and I was like, you know, I'm used to dealing with English as a second language students. It's nothing. And he was like, English is my fourth language. And so ever since that rocked my damn world. One that I assumed he only knew two.
You know, they multi.
And to me, patriarchy is the only excuse, because it's not even logical for us to be this far behind.
I know.
Everyone
else.
I
know. And we are behind in so many ways and think we know everything.
Don't know nothing. Because a perfect example of that, the Zimmerman trial. Kevin wrote a piece about it.
Mm-hmm,
and I'm just watching Don West talk to Rachel Gentile and saying he doesn't know. And it's like, you know what she is saying, but you're just trying to get her angry you can discredit her as a witness. You know damn well.
Race is working so, you know, in so many ways in that trial. It is something else. How the race card was played on so many levels.
So many levels
in that, you know.
So many levels.
It was just terrible. How y'all gonna kill the people's son and say that he caused his own death? He caused his own death from walking down the street, minding his own business.
In his father's neighborhood.
In his father's neighborhood. After the police told you not to get out your car. And they let that jury get off with saying that he was the aggressor.
Systemic.
And the man is following me now.
They were saying so much.
Yeah.
But one of the things I kept asking myself, like saying like June, July, August, was how am I supposed to have any little bit of self-esteem when I know that my body has no worth in this paradigm?
I know, it doesn't.
None of it makes sense other than
make sense.
Patriarchy, racism, institutionalized.
Because look at your hair, look at my hair. Something is wrong with us.
Right.
Something is wrong with us.
Child.
And even if we straightened it or cut it all off or whatever, we still got this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, like how you going to get rid of yourself to fit in? You know, I don't want to.
Pulling up those pants are not going to keep you from being oppressed.
See what I'm saying? See?
Yeah. And you know we see the same thing with those police and women's dress and all that type of stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
It's just too much.
It's too much.
What is it?
It's too much, my nephew.
It's too much going on. It's too much going on right now. And so that's why it's hard to be, like, say, a Black intellectual.
I know.
Because you critically thinking through all this stuff. It's too much,
my nephew.
You're feeling all oppressed and repressed and depressed.
I'm telling you, I was going to bed early every night during the Trayvon Martin trial because I just couldn't. It got to a point where I couldn't watch it anymore. My stomach was hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And my stomach is still hurting about so many other things. I just saw a slice of a documentary the other day about the infant mortality rate in Cleveland, Ohio, which rivals any third world country.
Damn.
And they talked about that the Black women in Cleveland, Ohio had the highest infant mortality rate, higher than some third world countries. Mm-hmm. Can you believe it?
Yes.
People are poor. They got these stereotypes about people playing the system and just keep having babies and this and that. And these are people who are not playing. They were showing people who worked 7 days a week. People who were going to school and worked and had kids, and they just didn't have even time to rest. And so they were having their babies prematurely, mm-hmm. having a 2-pound baby, and then your baby dies. Or, you know, just people with, you know, no support. People with no support who are working hard. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And some who maybe were not working, but they were trying to take care of their children.
You know what I mean? Job.
I know, and they would go for for food stamps, and they would tell them, "Oh, well, you know, your stamps will start in 7 weeks." Well, I don't have anything to eat right now.
Thank you.
So
we're talking about a baby.
7 more weeks, you know. So I'm not getting proper nutrition. Mm-hmm. I don't have any money. I might be staying from here to here to here, and then you wonder why my baby dies.
Mm-hmm. Or you wonder why my baby dies. Or you wonder why I'm stealing Pampers from Walmart and food
saying.
And stuff.
See what I'm saying? It's so that made me, that just, you know, and it was like, it's so much, you know, it's so much. And that's why, you know, I feel like our scholarship has to really, you got to bring it as much as you can in people's face, because mm-hmm. it's just like another movie. People just turn the channel. And there's people dying every day. And they don't have to be dying.
So.
But we got to end on a happy. Are we still taping? Mm-hmm. Okay, we got to end, hopefully, with hope, uplift. We can't end on the infant mortality rate in Cleveland.
We can't
end on the worthlessness of a black body. Or queer body.
Because my body, well, my queer body has plenty of worth. Just ask.
My body all over your body.
For us, I'm not listening to what the man says. I know my body got value. But, yeah. So, okay. So, like, one thing I've been saying to people, random people, wearing a pencil mind, the last thing I always say is, like, keep hope alive. You are somebody. And when I first started saying it, I was saying it as a joke, just ripping off Jesse Jackson and stuff. But then I realized how radical that statement was, especially back then. So especially now, how radical it is to look at someone and say, you are somebody in spite of all this bullshit.
Okay. So, I love my brother RuPaul.
Yes.
RuPaul said, if you don't love yourself, how in the hell
you going to love somebody else? Can I get an amen up in here? This. No, RuPaul is the consummate rhetorician. Rhetorically agile as shit.
Oh, RuPaul.
Trust.
Oh, my God.
And an icon and a brand who is not a like, is a black history staple, but no one references it.
Oh.
Like, let's talk.
Oh, that's some work that needs to be done. That's some work.
You know, I'm gonna get in that.
Go now.
Do it.
Teach.
Teach. Read. RuPaul, like, because do you watch the RuPaul's Drag Race? There are so many interesting gender and race dynamics going on up and through there.
I know.
Dope. Especially when we're talking about, like, say, their conversation between, like, camp drag and, like, glamour drag, or, you know, it's the same type of dichotomies, everywhere.
Everywhere. You can't get out of it.
Mm-hmm. You really can't. I'm so glad you like RuPaul. Like,
man.
See, now that's what's going to make me end up doing something on him, because, again, that rhetorical agility.
Oh, my God.
That's why I like black people and minorities in general and queer people. You have to take on these different personas for survival. Mm-hmm. So it's like when I'm walking into a composition classroom or a rhetoric classroom, and you're telling me, like, what these people have said about it and how, you always got to be aware of audience analysis, all that. Please, I've been throwing shade since I was 5. Like, I know, I'm always aware of audience. Like, y'all ain't telling me nothing new.
Okay.
You know? But I need to learn your language so that I can make the whole thing discernible.
Yes.
You know?
Isn't that something? And that's what I fought with writing this book, mm-hmm. because I would do a draft and I would let somebody read it, and they would, you know, some people said they couldn't understand the Ebonics, or they couldn't understand how it was spelled. You know, like, I liked it, but I didn't know if I knew it. And this would be people who spoke Ebonics, you know. And so it's a battle with writing, you know, like, at some point you got to take a stand and say, I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. I'm going with this because of, you know, this is what I'm trying to put out there.
I would like to give a special shout out to Dr. E for taking time to sit down and chat with me. And also, I'd like to thank all you guys for listening. This has been Seth E. Davis for This Rhetorical Life.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric Program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Seth Davis.